Mr. Shinoda, I wonder if we could follow up at this point logically. The actual creation of the Corvette, as you know now, and especially who were the people involved in the creation, design, and body engineering, and perhaps marketing, and then gradually your involvement with its evolution.
Well, I came on at GM in September of 1956, mm-hmm. and of course the car had been done earlier. And I'm quite sure Claire McKeegan had a big part of the design.
As
the chief designer of the Chevrolet studio.
Right.
He'd had several assistants. A fellow named Bob DeRuyter had been involved in the design of the car.
How do you spell that, please?
V-E-R-Y-Z-E-R.
DeRuyter. He was one of the basic designers.
Well, he was one of the designers. There was Carl, I can't think of his name. Carl Renner was another one of the designers.
Renner, R-E-N-N-E-R.
Right. And there was a Bob, Bob Cadaret.
How do you spell that?
C-A-D-A-R-E-T.
Those three were the...
There were some of the major designers on the car.
Under Claire McKeegan.
Right. And there was another fellow, Chuck Stebbins.
Stebbins. S-T-E-B-B-I-N-S.
Right. Mm-hmm. They had all worked, and I'm sure there were others, but mm-hmm. these are the ones that worked on the... I'm pretty sure worked on the 53, 54, mm-hmm. 55 Corvette. And then one of the directors of design... was heavily involved, and this was with Ed Glowacki.
How do you spell that, Jim?
It's G-O...
G-L-O?
G-L... G-L-O-W-A...
C-K-I?
C-K-E, I believe.
Now, what was Ed Glowacki, what was his position there?
He was a director of design.
For?
And of course, he worked under Mr. Mitchell. He had also been the chief in Cadillac Studio.
Oh, I see.
But he had worked on the car, I believe it was prior to the Cadillac Studio business.
I see. With the virtue of hindsight, can you look back and discern whose idea was it to come up with a rather innovative two-seater sports car?
Well, I think it was really Harley Earls.
Right. He sold it to the company.
And then, of course, they did the different, prior to the Corvette, there was the XP300 Buick show car.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Don't know that much about it. But
that was one of Earls. Did he assign that to Mitchell to do that?
I'm not sure. It most likely was, but then there was... Then there was a LeSabre that it was Mr. Earl's own personal sports car.
Show car.
It was shown. It had the top. It had a cell, so if a mini moisture hit it, the top would come up.
Really?
Yeah, and it had all kinds of different things.
Mini moisture head? What's that?
Yeah, I'm not sure what they call it in those days, but people always used to say, somebody could spit at it and the damn top would go up,
It was a sensor. Some type of primitive sensor that would lift the top up.
If it started to rain, the top would come up. It had everything you could think of.
Ford later picked that up at one point, I think, and used it for a time, but not very long. So there was a tradition of innovative private special design work leading up to a two-seater sports car.
Right.
Now, who do you think, this gentleman who is, usually his name comes up with it, is it Zora?
Zora Arkas Duntoff.
Now, what was his role in the actual?
Well, he actually came on board at Chevrolet, I think, in 1954, or early 55.
I see, not until then,
And then he was probably more involved with the engine.
Mm-hmm. He was really an engine man.
He was an engine man, mainly an engine man.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And he came up with a special camshaft for the V8 engine, it was called a Duntoff cam, which sold thousands and, or millions over the years.
Did he patent it for the company?
Well, it was patented, yes, for the company, and then he got involved in giving it some of the European aura of design.
Oh, yes.
So, and he's a very flamboyant character.
Oh, is he?
He really wasn't the real designer of the car. Mm-hmm. In later years, as it became a competition model, he got more and more involved.
More and more credit.
Right.
He really wasn't deserved.
Well, I think it was deserved, but he was a staff engineer and he had several people working for him that probably did a good bit of the work. You know, Zora's a close friend and so.
Is he still alive?
Yes, he is.
Does he live in the area?
Yes, he lives in Grosse Pointe. They're thinking of moving to Arizona.
Are they? I'd like to talk to him. Perhaps you could put in a good word for us.
Sure.
So the Corvette basically had been conceived and born a couple of years before you got there, through the year, but was that, what was one of your first assignments at, besides the late 50s, did you get assigned to the Corvette at all?
Well, initially I was, no I wasn't. My first involvement with the Corvette was after the Pontiac studio. I got involved in doing the first Stingray car.
Did you?
It was a race car. There was 1957 Chevrolet built an SS Corvette to race at Sebring. Mm-hmm. And I had just a little involvement on that car.
Stingray, the first Stingray?
Well, that was before the Stingray.
Oh, the SS, yes.
And then the SS Corvette. I had just a very minor involvement with that car. And then as the Stingray was, it was taking the test vehicle for this SS, was given to Bill Mitchell, and then he wanted to style his own body for it.
Now, tell us, at this point, Harley Earl had retired somewhat reluctantly. I think there was an ironclad rule at General Motors that they retired at 65, didn't they?
Right.
And although he wasn't ready to retire, the company was anxious to appoint a successor. And I understand that Mr. Earl designated Mr. Mitchell as his successor.
Right.
And sort of bolted through the executive ranks. Well, so Mr. Mitchell inherited, not in the sense of someone coming in new, but Mr. Mitchell had been with him for several years and had absorbed his philosophy and his way of looking at cars, and so he was very gung ho on this kind of a super racing car, was he not?
Right.
So how did you and he and the Stingray come to fruition?
There was another fellow that hadn't mentioned earlier.
Yes.
It was Bob McLean.
McLean. Mm-hmm. And
right.
What was his position?
And he was from Caltech. And,
which, of course, was the premier engineering school on the West Coast.
And he was a director in charge of research
for GM
Styling.
Uh-huh.
Mr. Earl had brought him in. Mm-hmm. Also had brought in Charlie Jordan, who is now the design director under Irv Verbicki.
Yes, uh-huh. They'd come in together.
No, not together.
But
Mr. McLean had came in earlier. He was... He was from Caltech. Chuck Jordan was a graduate of MIT.
Right, that's right, yeah.
And
this was an attempt, I think, by Mr. Earl to infuse a certain amount of mechanical background into design, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Mr. McLean had really a big part in the development of the earlier Corvettes and the Stingray car itself. In fact, one of his aerodynamicists forced the inverted airfoil shape again on that car, and it was the same people that did the thing for the Chaparral, and in all cases it didn't work. And I had to work around that.
Were you standing on the sidelines watching this? I
had to tell him that it wasn't going to work, and uh-huh. So I was kind of a thorn in some people's sides. Even at one point McLean even made the statement, "God damn you, son, I bet you ought to go back to California and cut grass," which was, kind of a nasty slur. And
completely insensitive.
Yeah, well, it was. And, we became very good friends afterwards.
Eventually,
but
yeah.
But he said that in front of Frank Winchell, and I think that really struck a bad chord. Winchell was about ready to take his head off.
Now, who was Frank Winchell?
Frank Winchell was chief engineer at Chevrolet for research and development. Uh-huh. And we were involved in some projects when McLean made that statement. And mm-hmm. He later became vice president of engineering staff.
He was good then?
Yeah, extremely good man. Yeah, he's now retired.
You had the experience with the chaparral, and you said, look, it isn't going to work this way?
Yeah, it's not going to work. And
did you tell them what they should be doing?
Right, well, we tried to, but then it, and so we finally,
Stonewall.
Finally, we were able to get it through that their design didn't really work.
Mm-hmm. The wind tunnel?
At that point in time, I think they falsified the wind tunnel, or they didn't know how to really read the studies, because
doctored the results?
Well, they didn't really doctor them, but Mitchell liked the design, so they built the car.
And, to his specs.
To his specs, and it really didn't have the downforce they talked. It had extremely high lift, so the 63 Corvette was an aerodynamic disaster.
Really?
Yeah.
It was a production car, and they
came up
with that?
Well, it had 150 miles an hour, the front wheels would lift off the ground. As far as a straightaway, it's a very stable situation. Uh-huh. But if you have to turn, then you're in disaster. But
were there any accidents that finally?
I don't think so. But
test showed conclusively that it would do that.
Yeah. And all the numbers, the front end lift was extremely high. And of course, the CD number, the coefficient of drag, was quite high. Mm-hmm. I believe that car had a coefficient of drag of an area of about 0.5 or 0.49, which is extremely high now. And your present passenger cars are all in the area of 0.3, 3.5 or lower.
When you say 0.5, 0.3, what kind of measurement is that?
Well, it's just, that's a coefficient of, the coefficient of drag in the figure.
It's a result.
It's a result of, I can't really explain it totally, but it's a measurement number that you come up with.
But is it in degrees or there's not a unit of measurement that you can relate it to?
No, not really, but it's,
it's just a mathematical
Conclusion. The 0.5 is extremely high. Like your latest Ford Probe is at 0.15 or 1.115 or something on there, in that area. Mm-hmm. And here's something at 0.5, which, then you would take a great big truck, 18-wheeler truck, that anomaly would be at a 0.8, 0.85 or 0.9. So, that kind of gives you the, where you'd be.
Yeah. Obviously, the mileage was very poor.
It probably at best couldn't be very good. No.
Yeah. Well, how did it come about that? Were you able to point out to them that the,
Not really. It was one of those things that was, your so-called designer, stylist, or whatever, you can't tell engineers their business.
Yeah.
And so, you worked around it.
Mm-hmm. How'd you do that?
Well, as far as the racing car, it was setting the attitude. We got the car as low as possible, and we ducted the radiator. That was one of the things they did have correct, was they were ducting the air into the radiator in the low area, and they were ducting it out through the hood, which would give...
Ducted, that's D-U-C-T?
Yeah.
And what type of conveyance would they use?
Well, they were just, the radiator was leaned over at an angle of about 45 degrees, mm-hmm. and it was taking in the air in on the bottom and extracting it out to the top.
Okay.
So what that would do, it would give the front a certain amount of downforce.
Uh-huh.
And in a way that was really, and then the angle of attack of the Stingray race car was pretty much nose down with the tail slightly up. So uh-huh. it did work as a race car, but...
it could have worked much better.
Yeah, it could have worked a lot better if it had better drag numbers and perhaps a different shape. But
how far did the Stingray get before that was corrected?
Well, it never was corrected.
It never was corrected. Really? The first ternary had nothing?
No.
Were you able to take Mitchell aside and say, look, this is...
No, he, I think he got to understand it, that it...
He sided with engineers initially.
Right, well, and then the 63 Corvette was the first production job, mm-hmm. and that ran all the way through 67. Mm-hmm. And the 68 was the first, was actually the second major, you know, body change. The first body change was on the 63 Corvette, mm-hmm. which ran through 67, and then the 68 was a new change, and that basically ran all the way up until 1980 through 83.
Were you, now you're going pretty fast here, what role did you play in their development?
In the 63, I was heavily involved in the whole car.
Mm-hmm.
And then the styling of the actual theme model, the Stingray production car, coupe.
Mm-hmm.
We did the theme models all down in this basement studio.
Now, that's been described as, the first time you were down in the basement, you were a bit put out. You thought it was a not a very prestigious place to be. But the second time, you have a sort of a super secret Mitchell idea studio, don't you?
Well, I think there's a mistake here. Was when I went back to Ford the second time, I was put in the basement.
What was that? I'm sorry.
Yeah, that was at Ford.
I beg your pardon.
See, being in the basement at GM.
Ford, GM was not a that was a good connotation.
That was a good connotation, okay. Right.
So when did that happen? When did you get into Mr.
Well, that would have been late 58.
Okay.
It might have been early 58.
Now, was this Mitchell's idea studio,
right,
his
right.
advanced concept studio? At least for racing type cars.
Right, he got me in there and we worked on the Stingray car, and then we worked on the different Shark model cars. And
before we get into that, tell us a little bit about Mr. Mitchell and your relationship with him. How do you differ from Earl?
Well, I never really worked that closely with Mr. Earl.
Mm-hmm.
He was the big boss. And
he was somewhat distant.
He was somewhat distant.
Yeah.
Whereas Bill Mitchell was a lot closer. Like, I understood what he was talking about, and then I could make things happen, sketch what he wanted to see, and then do the models, or make sure the models were handled properly.
You could translate his ideas into models. You mentioned at one point that he would make a rough sketch, maybe on a napkin or an envelope or something, the sort of thing you wanted. And he'd hand it to you? And
yeah, I'd say, well, do something like this.
Uh-huh.
And then you'd do something exactly, very explicitly what he asked for.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'd always do that first. And then you'd do something that you thought how maybe should be.
Now, I was interested in that. Tell me how that worked. A sort of a process of flattering and softening up and then getting with your design.
Then he'd say, well, yeah, it's pretty good. He'd say, well, I'll do this and this. And so he'd always make some suggestions.
Yeah,
so
you'd
do the next thing, and then you'd make some more sketches, and then he'd see the model, and he'd come in, and he'd take a knife, and he'd scratch on the model, say, maybe you do this or that.
You're talking about the clay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But normally, only if it was way off would he take the knife and scratch anything, you know.
So he would have a concept or an outline in his mind, and he'd be able to give you a rather crude sketch. And he'd expect you to translate this into precisely what he wanted.
Yeah.
But you were able to, by means of by means of carefully altering but keeping the basic concept of his design, you were able to inject your own ideas into the model. And on the whole, he would accept these.
Usually would, right. In fact,
it was unusual, wasn't it? Huh?
Yeah, in some cases, because I guess he found that there are a lot of guys he couldn't do that with, you know, that,
right.
You know,
they didn't like that.
What they wouldn't do, they wouldn't come forth and give him their own thoughts.
Okay.
You know, they just do what he asked, and they never, they'd always come up kind of short, so.
Do you think, looking back on that was deliberate on his part? Do you think he was hoping that you would be creative and innovative and build on his design?
That's what he wanted.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what he'd always say. He'd say, God damn it, do what I asked for first, and then show me something better.
Ah, okay.
And if you got him, it's better. He says, we'll do it. Of course, I'll sign my name to it. He'd laugh, you know.
But of course, that's what happens.
Yeah, sure. Well, that's.
It turns out, you know, that all these years, you, the public hasn't known that you were the person behind some of his most successful concept cars.
Well, it's the same thing, you know. It's kind of the same thing with Knutson. A lot of things that I've done over the years were some of his more successful things also.
I want to get back to that briefly. I realized that we'd skipped your accomplishments at Pontiac, and is that where you were first assigned when you first came in?
Right. Well, first it was Chevrolet, and then and Knutson had me switched over to Pontiac.
He wanted you over there. Now, Knutson was at that point a rather ambitious gentleman, and was attempting to build a base within the company, and was given this rather moribund division, the Pontiac, had he not, and said,
right,
look, see what you can do with it.
Right.
And so how does that come about, you and he as a team?
Well, as a team, I worked on did a little bit of work on the 58, but not very much. That car was pretty well done.
Pretty well set.
We did the race car that was raced at Daytona. It was a 57 Pontiac.
Was it? And that was very successful, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was quite successful. Yeah. And then the 58 Pontiac was also successful.
Can you say why and what your contributions were?
Well, my only contributions on the 57 Pontiac, the one that ran at Daytona, was the chemically milling the body, and then some of the trim, the attitude of angle of attack, attitude, the front air band that we didn't really know we had even
that,
done.
Yeah. Okay.
And then in the 58 models, Sink followed kind of the same plans, and he also built a good car.
Mm-hmm. Sink was the major designer.
And then, but then he didn't really run that car. He built the car, and he didn't actually race the car at Daytona. Mm-hmm. The involvement at Indy was too heavy, and he backed out of the stock car part of it.
You're speaking about Knutson?
No, this was this John Sink.
John Sink, he was the general.
No, John Sink was just. He was a multimillionaire from Tulsa, Oklahoma, that owned the race cars. Well, he had backed out of the stock car part and was devoting all his time to the Indy cars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then I was working at GM in 58, 57, 58, and in 58, basically I got transferred out of the production studio into this special studio. Prior to that, I'd worked on the 59 wide track Pontiac.
Just a little bit about that. There's a rumor about that was accidental. Not so?
Yeah, it was.
How did it come about?
Well, it came about, there were some problems, and Knutson asked a bunch of people, when the 59s were going to come out, they were basically, they were carryover 58 chassis.
Were they?
The chassis was 58. Which was 58, and which was kind of a widened 57.
Uh-huh.
The 57 was a narrow body, the 58 was a wider body, but it was still a narrow chassis, and they looked kind of knock-kneed. And Knutson says, what the hell can we do? And DeLorean was one of the engineers.
John DeLorean?
Yeah.
Was in the Pontiac engineering.
Right. In fact, we started at GM the same day.
Did you really?
Yeah, we both came from Packard. And
uh-huh.
He went to Pontiac Engineering, and I went to Stirling.
That's right. Yeah.
But I think.
But he was then assigned to Pontiac. But you were assigned to Pontiac at the same time, or?
Yeah, Pontiac Studio.
Yeah.
And I didn't have anything to do with the wide track. Although, when we showed some drawings, some full-size drawings, and it was a rendering, full-size front-end renderings, and we'd heard him talking about doing the wide track thing.
Right.
We just. Did the renderings, and we widened the track out even wider than what they were supposed to be. So
are you and DeLorean?
No, this was I was working for a fellow named Joe Szymanski at the time.
Szymanski. Huh?
He was a chief designer in Pontiac Studio.
I spell that. Szymanski.
No, it was a Polish spelling.
Szyz something.
Right.
Yeah, okay, we'll get it. Yeah.
Now he's retired and living in Australia.
Is he really?
He went. GM sent him to Australia, and then he.
So you and he noticing the disparity between the chassis and the.
So we just
and the body.
We just set the tires way out wide, and then of course they, I think DeLorean and Estes are the ones that noticed it.
Were they?
Mm-hmm.
Pete Estes?
Yeah, their chief body engineer was a fellow named Herm Kaiser.
K-I-Z-E-R.
Right.
Yes, uh-huh.
And they said, well, what the hell, why not? Mm-hmm. So they had an exclusive on the white track.
They certainly did.
And, you know, it became an advertising glitch, and it, you know, in the car, the stance was much better than the other cars.
It certainly was, yeah. So, it was a masterstroke in terms of pragmatic adjustment to a bad situation.
Yeah, because it was a bad situation.
Cause, yeah.
You know, all the Ford cars looked knock-kneed in that same era.
Right, yeah.
Their wheels were subway in.
Yeah.
And the Chevrolets were all that way because their chief body engineer was a fellow named Carl Jakus. He was a farmer. J-A-K-U-S-T, I think.
Jakus. This was at Ford?
No, GM,
Ford,
Chevrolet.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And he was the guy that would, if the weather even started to look bad, he'd wear goddamn rubber galoshes in. And he was the guy always saying you had to put these milk cans in the back and stand up. So, you know, always call for these real deep trunks.
Right, yeah. So he was the guy behind all that, huh?
So, yeah, well, he was one of them.
Uh-huh, yeah.
You got to have chains, you got to have chain clearance, so, you know.
Mm-hmm. Still use chains in those days.
Well, the Pontiac, I think, had a problem with chains, but, you know.
Getting the parts of the chassis.
You know. Yeah, because, you know, the track was, you know, when they went to the complete white track.
Mm-hmm.
But
well, was Bunky pleased with this? He must have been.
Oh, yeah.
What did he say?
Well, he says, he was pleased. He says, you know, goddamn it, you know, it takes a racer to see this. You know, that's, you know, that was his philosophy. You know, and
at this point, maybe an instructive little time we have left on this reel to give us a sort of thumbnail sketch of John DeLorean as you knew him at Pontiac.
Well, when I first met him, he was at Packard. And
that's right. Yes,
he was. He was the chief engineer for Advanced Chassis.
Was he?
And one of his quirks were, he was heavy into torsion bars, and torsion bar suspension, and flexible drive shafts.
Now those were innovative ideas in those days.
Well, the flexible drive shaft was a fairly innovative idea that turned out to be a kind of a disaster.
Or it didn't work.
Well, at Pontiac they finally did one for the Tempest, and it became a real sounding box that just made so damn much noise they finally gave it up. But it ran a couple of years.
How about the other one you mentioned?
Torsion bars, they worked real slick on the Packards.
Did they?
He never got it to,
because the Packards were so heavy?
Yeah, well, and of course, he had a real nice adjustment, height adjustment system.
Uh-huh.
In fact, Dick Teague used to use that he used to use a big Packard Patrician or whatever, and had the suspension.
Uh-huh.
So when he'd steal stuff from Packard, he could load it all in the trunk and it would sag down, and then he would hit the suspension and jack it up and drive out. Because he ended up taking up probably the majority of the Packard archives, moved them out to Franklin.
Oh my gosh. He just moved to California. This is here.
I wonder how many trucks it took to move all this stuff.
I wish I'd known that. I have to query him about that. What happened to the Packard archives?
Yeah, because he had the whole Packard archives.
Really? In terms of records and
records, everything.
Drawings,
brochures, you name it, he had it.
Oh gosh, you could see the writing on the wall.
Yeah.
Well, DeLorean was pretty slick, though, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was pretty slick.
It's pretty innovative.
Yeah, innovative, but also hard-headed.
Oh, was he?
Yeah.
He didn't want to be told that.
No, and then if somebody that he kind of believed in had a good or bad idea,
mm-hmm.
he'd almost take it right down the tube. I mean, you know,
he rejected it out of hand.
No. He would think that that was the end result, and nothing could be any better.
Oh,
and somebody brought to him the Mercedes low pivot rear suspension, which
mm-hmm.
was a form of a swing axle,
mm-hmm.
and it wasn't optimum.
Mm-hmm.
And he deemed it was optimum, and you know, he beat that to death. And they finally had to get rid of it at the Tempest.
Once he achieved a certain plateau where he thought was the optimum use, he wouldn't go any further.
Well, no. He would keep, even if it was a bad idea, he would keep pushing it.
Oh, I see. He wasn't able to distinguish between a good and a bad idea.
Well, but I don't think so. In fact,
his subsequent career, I guess, would prove that.
Yeah, right. Well, of course, like on his car, you know, the rear of his car is beautiful. The front's terrible. I mean, it looks like somebody gave it a, you know, Sylvester Stallone gave it a real hard uppercut and bent the nose up.
This is Giugiaro, isn't it?
Well, Giugiaro designed it, but whoever it's.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, either one of them. Well, Giugiaro is known to. It's been known to screw up also.
Now you're talking about the, what's it called, the DMC-2?
Well, one or two DMC, period, was.
Yeah. Okay.
The first car was very, very stiff, and then Giugiaro, you know, softened it up before they produced it.
Yeah.
It still has that same, you know, pushed up nose.
Yeah. But John, in spite of that, he seemed to go fairly high in the engineering and manufacturing councils.
Right.
Did he not? Yeah.
He had a lot of good ideas, and then of course, you know, he would get on some pet peeves, and which I wouldn't always agree with, but
like what?
Well, they were doing a sports car that was going to compete with the Corvette,
mm-hmm.
and he had these ideas on using this low pivot rear suspension, and the first car. I think there was a car that was called the Banshee they did, and then they